Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. You know, I'm incredibly glad to be here tonight. You know, I know the residents know this, but for some of the family members, if you haven't figured this out yet, there's something really special that goes on here. There's a spirit that moves through this place and enables the hopeless to gain hope. I was very much influenced by the person who put this place together, Mark Houston. He was a friend of mine and certainly an unbelievably powerful teacher. He was one of the enlightened masters out there that had to do with recovery. And you know, his loss is great. I'm also very, very close to the people that continue the vision and continue operating and you know, making improvements and keeping this going. If you're a resident, you have no idea how lucky you are to have landed here. There are some places out there I'm very, very familiar with and I'm very involved with. The addiction and alcoholism recovery business and landscape. I've been a board member of the NCADD for many years and some other boards. And I know what type of processes are out there. I know where you can land. And you can land in places that don't have a tenth of the amount of spiritual transformational ability that happens in Benchmark. Alcoholism is an unorthodox illness. Drug addiction is an unorthodox illness. It's very, very difficult for us to come to terms with this and to truly understand it. It presents in so many different ways. We have so many belief systems that wrap around alcoholism and addiction that are wrong, that are not really helpful for promoting recovery. It's really, there are actually people out there who you pay to treat your alcoholism or your drug addiction that just don't even have a clue what it really even is. You know, sometimes they truly think that it's behavioral choices or something, you know. And alcoholism, more and more science is in, folks, and it's more of a genetic bullet than anything else. You know, if we're potential alcoholics or potential drug addicts and we use alcohol or we use drugs, what happens is we're caught up in something very, very quickly that is more powerful than our ability to be able to control it. And all of a sudden now we're trying to manage something that's unmanageable. My first drink was when I was about 13 years old. I decided I was going to cut school with some of my friends, and we were going to go back to my house, and we were going to get drunk. You know, we'd seen this on TV, and we thought it would be like a really cool thing to do. And that's what we did. We went back to my house, and I took down a bottle of Four Roses whiskey out of my parents' closet, and I poured three big water glasses, or two of my buddies there. I didn't know how to drink whiskey. Listen, warm Canadian whiskey out of water glasses is a good way to go. Today, if I smelled it today, I'd have a gag reflex. But I poured out these glasses. Now, two of the guys that I was drinking with did not become alcoholic. As far as I know, they never became problem drinkers. And it's interesting to see what their reaction to the alcohol was. And it was this. They drank about two-thirds of the glass, and they had enough. You know, as I moved through my drinking career, that used to piss me off unbelievably to drink with somebody that's had enough. You know, no thanks, no more for me, Chris. I've had enough. I go nuts. Hey, it's only 11 o'clock. Let's go to the city, you know? Because I wanted more out of alcohol. So anyway, what happened is they had their two-thirds of the glass and they sat back and they watched the show. Because that's not the reaction I had to alcohol. The reaction I had to alcohol was, was, up until this point in time, I was a very shy, very anxious, very repressed 13-year-old. I always felt uncomfortable in crowds and in school, and there was always something wrong, or I always wanted to be somewhere else, or, you know, I was afraid to engage, you know, with women or girls, or, I always felt less than or better than, you know, I was just totally disconnected. When I started drinking that Four Roses whiskey, all of a sudden everything changed. All of a sudden I'm like, ah, you know, for the first time in my life, I felt okay. I felt great. And the more I drank, the greater I felt. And, you know, all of a sudden I felt larger than life. All of a sudden I did not care what you would think about me. Up until that point in time, I was so attached to whatever your opinion of me was, you know. And what that alcohol did for me was it gave me a freedom. It gave me an ability to just step out and just do or say anything. And just everything was chill, you know. And that was my experience. And then I became a drunken, vomiting pig. You know, because I didn't stop. I had like four glasses of this stuff, you know. And listen, I woke up in a field. I had my first blackout at 13. And then I was horribly sick for a couple of days. Anybody in here remember their first drunk? You know, you got to be horizontal for two days at least. And I was just unbelievably sick. But what stuck in my mind was what alcohol did for me. Alcohol did for me. Alcohol changed my perception of the world and made it more warm and more welcoming. And this is kind of what happens, folks, with alcoholics and addicts. A lot of times we find sobriety untenable. It's not comfortable. We you know, it's not, it's just, give me a drink, you know? And sometimes you think that it's the alcohol or the drugs, and that's the main problem. And if they could be taken away, everything would be fine. I want to tell you a story that'll kind of show that's not necessarily true. All right, this is like 1985. I'm a daily drinker at this time. I've got a terrible job, you know, a terrible car, and you know, everything's bad. But what I do is I get off of my terrible job and I go right to the liquor store, because when I go to the liquor store, it's like, you know, that's just what I do. And I've got this one liquor store I go to where I've got an understanding with the guy that manages it. And he knows not to run out of Gordon's Vodka or George Dickel Bourbon, okay? He knows this, and he's cool. It's always there. Now, this one, you know, so what happens is I've had a terrible day at work, and I drive to the liquor store, and I go in. You know, every day it's the same. And, I grab the bottle, I throw it down to $20, I go. And I get home, and I start drinking. Now, this one day, I grab my bottle of vodka, and I'm heading up to the cash register, and there's a woman there. And she's asking the guy questions. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, I got my $20 and my booze. And she's going, what kind of wine goes with tilapia? And he's answering her, right? She's like, well, you know, she got her day with a blush, you know. I'm like, are you crazy? Get that woman out of here. You got a vodka buyer here. Are you nuts? I got a problem. I'm sober. Okay? Get her out of here. Now, think about this. Think about this. Is the problem really the booze? The problem is I'm like a nut sober. I can't take it. And one of the most beautiful things in our history, one of the most insightful things in our history is the guy that 12-stepped Bill Wilson was a guy named Roland Hazard. And Roland Hazard was an alcoholic, and he was an alcoholic with money. He had enough money, you know, he could go to any of the Bettys he wanted to, you know, and he had a ton of money. And what he ended up doing was he went over to Europe and he found Carl Jung, who was about the most prestigious psychological practitioner of that time. He had the money, he could see him. And the story goes that he was with Carl Jung for a year. And Carl Jung did every kind of psychological thing. I mean, his head was so shrunk you could have put it on a mantle after he got done with Carl Jung. Okay? And so Carl Jung said, okay, I'm done. You know, you're cool. And the guy leaves. And he doesn't even make it to Paris before he's drunk. And he, you know, he's like, oh my God, I'm drunk. You know, so he goes back to Carl Jung. He's like, doctor, I'm drunk. You know, what's wrong with you? And you know how we are. And the doctor said, look, you know, I was worried about this. You're one of those hopeless alcoholics. You know, I've never seen anybody as hopeless as you recover. You know, you need to be locked up or you're going to die or go insane. You know, here's your bill. And Roland goes, no, wait, there's got to be something, you know. Please, isn't there anything? And here's what Carl Jung said. He goes, yes, there is. Every once in a while, I've heard that there are spiritual or religious conversion experiences that happen. They're so profound that it's a complete change in personality. And this is the only thing that anyone has ever seen that's worked for an alcoholic of your type. You know, so if I were you, I would go try to find that experience. And Roland's like, well, how do I do that? And Carl Jung's, I don't know, it's a phenomenon, you know. Probably the best thing for you to do is get involved in a really religious organization, something. And so that's what Roland does. He comes back to America and he joins up with the Oxford Group. The Oxford Group is where Alcoholics Anonymous came from. The Oxford Group is where the original 12 steps that our recovery process came from. And when Roland Hazard came back and he got involved in the Oxford Group, all of a sudden he got sober. Now what the Oxford Group was at that period of time is it was a Christian organization, but they believed that to go to church on Sunday for an hour wasn't even close to cutting it. They wanted to see you Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night. You gotta go preach over here. You gotta witness here. You gotta get a convert there. You're gonna go feed people in the homeless shelter. I mean, they had you busy in the Oxford Group. And the alcoholics that fell into this Oxford Group and did all this spiritual action were able to separate from alcohol and were able to show some kind of a recovery. Now, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob both landed in this spiritual milieu, and Alcoholics Anonymous was basically formed. So what they learned back in those days was they learned just how alcoholism works, and they learned this from their own experience. Alcoholism or drug addiction, if you're a real alcoholic or a real drug addict, what that looks like is you have what's known as an obsession of the mind. What will happen is no matter how much you want to stay away from drugs and alcohol, no matter what the consequences are if you use drugs and alcohol, you can desperately want to separate from drugs and alcohol, and you end up drinking anyway because of the insane obsessions that basically present in the alcoholic or the drug addict. I experienced these myself because the last 4 years of my drinking, I was desperate to separate from alcohol. And here's basically what would happen. I would come to in the morning just as sick as you could possibly be. I'd come to in the morning, and I would swear to God, from the moment I woke up, I would swear to God, today's going to be the day. Today is the day that I'm going to give up alcohol. Today's going to be the day. And if you were to put a lie detector on me, the polygraph guy would say, Chris, are you ever going to drink again? And I would say, no. Today's the day. I'm quitting today. And the needle would go right to true. I meant it. I absolutely meant with every fiber of my being that I was going to quit drinking. Have any of your loved ones ever looked you right in the eye and said, I absolutely am done, I'm absolutely done, and ended up using again? Okay? Well, this is what I personally experienced. I was absolutely going to quit that day. and I'd go off to work feeling worse than a hangover. It was like alcohol poisoning. I was like shattered. I'd go to my bad job, and because I was an electrician, I'd blow stuff up and electrocute people by accident. I'd get through the day, you know, and sometime around noon, I'd put a half a sandwich down, I'd rehydrate, and I'd start to feel a little bit human. And I would start to say to myself, you know that decision that you made this morning about never, ever drinking again, that's a pretty serious, that's kind of an overreaction. I think I'm going to have to modify. As a matter of fact, I'm going to have to stop at the liquor store on the way home, and I hope the tilapia lady is not here. So I've gone from this morning absolutely swearing off alcohol to going and buying another quart and getting drunk out of my mind and feeling sick the next morning again. Listen, I made the mistake of actually thinking I played a part in that decision. You know, what it is alcoholism and drug addiction. They talk about, the first step talks about powerless. Well, powerless is powerless, actually. I mean, think about it. If I was able to say, I'm done and I'm absolutely done, then I wouldn't be powerless. Well, the brilliance of the 12-step process is it asks us to surrender to the fact that we may not be able to manage our own alcoholism and our own drug addiction. You know, so you have to place, if that's true, what do you have to do? Here's the great news about a place like this. If you're powerless, the answer has to be power. You need to find a power greater than yourself that can solve your alcohol or your drug problem. It's pretty simple, but it's very difficult for alcoholics, and it's certainly difficult for family members to get. Because we so want to think that if someone has good motives, good things will happen. But that's not necessarily true with this addiction. So what is the answer? What is the answer? Well, to seek that power, which will solve the problem. The great thing about Bill and Bob and the early Alcoholics Anonymous members was they got right away that you don't fight alcoholism with sobriety. It doesn't work. You fight alcoholism with spiritual living. Because they learned that in the Asher group, because they did all these spiritual religious exercises. They got really busy doing all this stuff that was actually selfless work. It was stuff to actually help other people. It's crazy. The alcoholic or the drug addict, they manifest and they present with a remarkably deep and chronic selfishness and self-centeredness. You know, that's part of what happens with alcoholism and drug addiction. So the spiritual exercises that are inherent in the 12 steps, what they're designed to do is they're designed to offer us freedom from that bondage of self. Freedom from being critically attached to, freedom from being the guy freaking out because there's a tilapia lady in front. You know what I mean? Freedom from that bondage of self. And that's what the 12 steps offer us. So here I am. I'm drinking. My drinking is really getting my attention. I also did drugs. I did mountains of drugs. You know, I'm really an alcoholic. The alcohol really nailed me. But I also did drugs alcoholically. one is good, a whole bunch is better. I remember the great Quaalude epidemic of 73. This will kind of show, you know, what. We had a smoking area outside of our high school, and we would all mingle in the smoking area before school started. And, you know, people would bring marijuana, you know, whatever, and we'd all partake. This one day, this guy comes up with a big bag of pills, and we're going, what's that? And he's going, well, they're Quaaludes. And We're like, well, what are Quaaludes? And he goes, oh, they're really great. And we go, how much are they? $1 a piece. Okay. And we're buying them. How many do you take? He goes, I don't know. I haven't done them yet. 2 or 3. So anybody that doesn't have any experience with Quaaludes, this is what they're like. One Quaalude is like immediately drinking a six-pack of 16-ounce malt liquors. You're noodled, okay? So there's about 60 of us who took like 3 Quaaludes before first period. And then went to high school. I got to tell you, the ambulance was back and forth all day long. I remember walking down the hall, hanging on the lockers like this, right? Exit. That's what I need to do. I need to exit. So I make a break for the exit, you know, and I go out into the woods, and I make it out into the woods, and there's people out there already hugging trees. It's a mess. Oh, the next day at school, people are looking at me laughing. What are you laughing about? Like one guy goes, yesterday, man, you know, you made a break for the woods past the whole 400 wing. And I'm like, so? He goes, it took you 5 minutes to go 100 yards. I thought I was hauling ass. So I would have trouble with drugs. The thing that you need to understand is I just want it out of me. Okay, why did I do all these drugs? You look at somebody that does a whole bunch of drugs, like, what are you, crazy? No, they don't like the reality that they're living. You know, they want to change it because it's uncomfortable. It's a spiritual illness. So I would take anything. I remember this one time we're going into New York City to some concerts. So we go into this concert, and you know we go into the bathroom because that's where you buy drugs, and we buy some LSD. You know, we're kind of drunk, you know. So we bought some LSD. We did some, and we didn't get high quick enough, right? So we got ripped off, man. You know, so we go back into the bedroom and we buy more. And you know, 10 minutes later, we're like, we're still not high, man. So we go back in and we buy more. But I gotta tell you, by the end of the concert, we're like. It's like Disney World, like projector in your head. We all you know, go out and we came in a van, right? So we all pile in the van. We're so, like, nobody's talking. We're so high. We're like, anybody that knows New York City, there's only a couple ways out. It's going through New Jersey. It's thinking of Holland Tunnel. Okay. Now the Holland Tunnel, getting to the Holland Tunnel was like 10 lanes, 8 lanes. 6 lanes, 4 lanes, 2 lanes, tunnel, right? So we're heading down the tunnel, and somebody in the front of the van goes, hey man, we'll never fit. Crazy stuff always happening. The crazier it was, the more normal it was, you know? And listen, alcoholism and drug addiction are progressively fatal illnesses. Over any considerable period of time, they always get worse. They never get better. And, you know, that's kind of some bad news. And what happened to me was I drank myself past all the drugs. And I just moved on to hard liquor, and it was just brutal. The last 4 or 5 years of my drinking were decadent and pathetic, and every single good thing in my life was like squeezed out of it. And every day that went by, my life got smaller and smaller and smaller. And I paid a higher and higher price for drinking. You know, the things that I put in the hat to continue to drink are unbelievable. I put a family in the hat. And I said, you know what? You guys don't want me drinking. I'm going to drink. Okay. You know. I put my driver's license in the hat a number of times. I totaled 9 cars in drunken blackout. I mean, you know, I came from a period of time when friends let friends drive drunk. You know, that's just the way it was when I was growing up. And I crashed a whole bunch of cars. And so I put my driver's license in. I put my health in. I burnt my mother's house down a couple of times. I mean, it just went from bad to worse. And every day it got worse. And it got to the point toward the end of my drinking where suicide really looked like a solution. You know, a really scary statistic is the alcoholic is about 60 times more likely to take their own life than a non-alcoholic. And, you know, what happens is that the more we drink, the more unmanageable our life gets. The more unmanageable our life gets, the more we drink. And we get to a point where it's just pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You know, and we get to a point where we just don't feel that we can move forward. And I got there. I got to that point. I got to that point in 1989. I signed myself into a treatment center, a 28-day treatment center. I went through the 28-day treatment center, and it was brutal. It was hard for me. I was really, really ill. I don't remember anything except going to group. And, you know, listening to somebody talk about what's going on and just thinking, I don't care what's going on with you. Why don't you just drink and get out of here? Because I want to share. This is like all I can remember from the 28-day treatment. I remember some Father Martin movies, which I hostily critiqued. Listen, I really wanted to separate from alcohol, but I didn't get what sitting in group means to me not drinking. And, you know, I didn't get it. Listen, alcoholism is an unorthodox illness. I know I drink too much. You know, what is all this other stuff that you're talking about? Why am I doing this therapy? Why are you handing me a couple of books that were written in the 30s and 50s? I didn't get it. But I tried to listen. So after I went through the 28-day treatment program, they said, okay, what you need to do is you need to go to outpatient. And we would really recommend that you go to some AA meetings. So I go, okay, you know, I don't want to, but I'll do it. So I'm going to 2 outpatient meetings and I'm going to 2 AA meetings every single week. What more do you people want? I'm doing it like it's castor oil drinking. Like, I gotta go to my meeting. You know? But I was doing it. So, you know, one day, on the way to an AA meeting, the thought crosses my mind that if I stop and buy a gallon of vodka and drink it, what it'll do is it'll improve my ability to do this recovery stuff. I'll be able to approach this with a whole new renewed enthusiasm. So I do it. I stop and I buy a gallon of vodka and I take it home and I start drinking. And I got one drink down. It's a good idea. This is one. 2 drinks are good. I get about half of the third drink down, and all of a sudden the enormity of my mistake comes into my consciousness. Like, oh my God, what have I done? I've opened up the cage door to the beast, and he's going to move me around like a puppet, you know, until he's done. Oh my God. You know, and that's exactly what happened for about 7 months. I was as drunk as you could possibly be. And it was just pathetic. And at the end of that, here's my last drunk. I go into a blackout, and it was a multi-day blackout. And when I come out of it, I don't know what's happened, but the house is empty. It's Christmas, okay? And my family's supposed to be there. The house is empty. I make some phone calls, and I find out what happened. I find out that I threatened my family with a handgun and told them that I was going to kill them all. I'm going to kill all you! And this was not the festive type of mood that they were really into. You know what I mean? They were very concerned. And so they took their Christmas elsewhere, thank you. And I came too, and I'm looking around, and there's nobody there, and I'm making phone calls. And I stagger into the kitchen, and there's a pile of vodka bottles in the sink like this. I don't remember buying any of them. I must have just been staggering up to the liquor store, you know, more vodka. It must have been awful. And I start to go into the DTs. The delirium tremens are awful. You want to talk about terror. You want to talk about the most uncomfortable you'll ever feel. And I see some heads nod of people who've experienced the DTs. You know, I went through this for about 2.5 days. And when I finally came out of these, I remember the only thing I could do is I had a copy of My Name is Bill W. It was a new movie at that time with James Garner and I was watching. I watched it over and over and over. I probably watched it 20 times while I was detoxing. And when I finally could, I got up and I got in a car and I drove to a meeting. And I was absolutely desperate at this point in time. Now, here's what I learned in my first year. You got to understand, my willingness was born of desperation. I was absolutely willing to do anything, and I was going to meetings like a maniac. I was probably going to 13 or 14 meetings every week. I would go out after the meeting, you know, with the people to the diner. I was a secretary here. I was a treasurer there. If you asked me to do something, if you asked me to go get somebody or give somebody a ride, I was there. I was all about this activity, and I was doing everything I thought I should do and more because I was so desperate. Now, alcoholism is a spiritual illness. A lot of people think that you treat alcoholism or you treat drug addiction by going to meetings. Going to meetings does not treat alcoholism or drug addiction. What going to meetings does is it places us in the atmosphere where we can encourage each other to continue living spiritual principles. Because it's the spiritual principles that treat alcoholism. I did not know that. For some reason, I got the impression that my meeting attendance was directly tied to my using and not using. So I'm going to a whole bunch of meetings, but you know what? The guy that cannot stand a tilapia lady in front of him is still there. I'm still absolutely crazy. People would come up, I got a year sober, right? People would come up to me, hey Chris, how you doing? Great, good. You know, the regular one-liner. What was really going on in my head, I couldn't tell them. I couldn't tell them what was really going on. What was really going on in my head was, I'm thinking, you know, you jerk, don't ask me, you know, I'll kill you. You know, I hate you. I'm going to ask me, get the hell away from me. I'm fine. You know, I was nuts. And there was a tension. I described the way I felt like a garage door spring. You know a garage door spring? It's got like 700 pounds of tension. It's just tight and wrapped up. It's ready to just snap at any moment. You know, that's what I was like. I was nuts. And all of a sudden, somebody comes up to me one day and says, Chris, you're hardcore. Here's some tapes I want you to listen to. And he gives me 8-9 minute tapes. And they were from a couple of guys from Arkansas named Joe and Charlotte. And this is one of their earlier workshops. And, I had a long ride to work. And I promised this guy I would listen to him. So I started listening to him. And they disturbed me. They disturbed me a lot. The message in these tapes disturbed me because I was not hearing it in the meetings. I was not hearing it from my sponsor. They talked about applying the principles and exercises of the book Alcoholics Anonymous in a fundamental way, like actually doing the steps instead of going to a lot of step meetings and believing in them in theory. You actually have to do them, and that's kind of what Joe and Charlie are talking about. And now I'm pissed. and people from Arkansas, you know, they're making me look bad. You know, they're holding up a mirror like, you know, like Chris, if you don't work a program out of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have a program. So when you go back out, please don't tell people that AA didn't work, because you didn't work AA. This is the message I'm getting from these kids. You know, so I put them up on the shelf. I'm upset. I'm thinking, you know, maybe that's the way they do it in Arkansas, you know. But in New Jersey, we go to meetings and share, you know. So, and boy, did we. You would not believe some of the things that you would hear in meetings. You know, some of them were like bad Bob Newhart, you know, group therapy with like, you know, no experience counseling, you know, just like a free-for-all. It was just horrible. No wonder it's not treating my alcoholism. It's not treating that tension I have inside, just to talk. So things happen in my life. A couple of things happen that are you know, disturbing. I lose a job. When Boy Meets Girl on AA campus, I found a hostage to take. I highly recommend that to anybody that wants to be thrust into the steps with every part of their fiber of being on fire. You know, I highly recommend that, because that's what happened to me. Because I found out that, you know, two people actually have to, you know, want a relationship. I'm just shot. I'm like shattered now. My alcoholism is all over me, and you know, life problems are all over me. And I remember this set of tapes, and I pull them back off the shelf. And I did not go into this work with a sense of virtue. I went into this work, excuse me, because I really just didn't want to feel bad anymore. You know, so often we take the right actions in our life because we're suffering the consequences of the bad actions. And that's really the way it was for me. I took these tapes down off the shelf, and I started playing them. I opened the big book. I got a pad and a pencil, and I started to the best of my ability to actually do the 12 steps. Didn't do a very good job, but what happened was I started to feel the effects of this step work. This step work is designed to heal your spirit. You jump ahead to the 12th step. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. That's the treatment for alcoholism. That's the treatment for drug addiction, the spiritual awakening. I'm working the steps. I'm working them because Joe and Charlie told me to, and I feel terrible. And all of a sudden, I start to feel a recovery experience. And I start to get, and other people are noticing it really before I am. They're saying, Chris, you know, what's going on? You're not a lunatic. I'm not afraid to sit next to you anymore. And what was happening was I was healing. And now as I was healing, people were paying attention, and there was a lot of people that were asking me to sponsor them. And you know, I did some oral tradition type sponsoring in the beginning. You know, I did basically what my sponsor did with me. But very soon I started to change how I did that. And basically what I started to do was to bring people over to my house and go through the big book the way Joe and Charlie went through the big book with me. And I would sit down and I would go through it page by page, and when there was an instruction, we would stop and we would do the instruction. And I didn't know any better, so I actually was doing a fourth step and doing the third step. I was doing these steps as I was working through with these other guys, just to kind of encourage them. So I was without knowing what I was doing, I was continuing to practice these principles in my life. And you know what happened was a really significant recovery experience. Because I was so influenced by these Joe and Charlie tapes, I got a recovery catalog. I was kind of a collector. I think the thing that was worth the most value in my life when I got sober was a comic book collection. How pathetic is that? But that's true. So I was a collector, and I started to collect big book workshops. And one of the first ones I got was, I look in this catalog and I go, Joe Hogg. I wonder what an American Indian would say about the 12 steps. So I got the Salvation Army tapes, and they just blew my mind. And if anybody's been exposed to these tapes, they were transformational. They took the mechanics of recovery and melded them with the spirituality of recovery, and they explained them in such a way that someone like me could put the pieces of the recovery puzzle together. And it wasn't long after that I'd been taking people through the steps, that it was about the mid-90s, and all of a sudden other big book workshops started to show up in these catalogs. And I was now paying close attention to Joe Hogg. All of a sudden, he started to do a whole bunch of workshops with a guy named Mark Houston. And I got a hold of the Virginia Beach, the Battle Creek, the Santa Monica. There was just a number of these big book workshops. And I started to just digest them. And what they did was they helped me to put even more pieces of the recovery puzzle together. And they helped me to work with other people in a little bit better way. Now, you know, what happens here? This place is built on a legacy that comes from that spiritual body of work. That's why I support this place so much. That's why what goes on here works so well. Because I don't think anyone in the history of recovery has been able to put together the foundation of recovery in this day and age better than those two guys. So anyway, now I'm really working a program. Now I'm really working the steps with people. And here's what I find out. This is a significant piece of information. It certainly was for me. A lot of people were asking me to sponsor them at that time. You know, I was pretty vocal about what was going on in my life, and for one reason or another, you know, people were asking me to sponsor them. And there was two kinds of people that would ask me. There was the people who just wanted to get out of the jackpot and wanted to use me as cover. They weren't really interested in actually doing all this stuff. It sounded good. And then there were people who were really desperate and who were willing to follow through with the spiritual step work. And here's what happened. Every single person that followed through with the steps with me is still sober today. I'm talking, we're going back into the early 90s. Every single one of these people, they're still card-carrying members in good standing and whatever fellowship they're in, still working with other alcoholics. Because what happened was, when you go through this process, you get a shot of the Spirit. You're actually exposed to a power greater than yourself that can do for you what you cannot do on your own unaided will. What happens is a whole bunch of power starts to come into your life, and that becomes very attractive. So you want to keep that going. And that's why I believe all these people are still sober. The people that balked at step four, or didn't want to do the amends, or really they weren't into this prayer and meditation thing, man. They're all gone. I don't know where they are. They're not in the recovery world that I'm in. I'm not really in touch with them anymore. They may not be drinking, but I have a feeling even if they were able to stay sober, their quality of life has been denigrated because of their inability to come to terms with the work that they needed to do to heal. You know, I believe so much in the work of the 12 steps, of the recovery process. I believe that that's what really changes us at depth. We can sometimes stay sober and we can sometimes stay clean for periods of time based on other things. But if you want to be able to do it in a comfortable way, if you want it to really be long-lasting and really mean a lot, you need to come to terms with the spiritual work that the alcoholic and the addict have to do. One of the things that's true about us as alcoholics and addicts is we are so separate. We're so separate. One of the things that Carl Jung said to Bill Wilson when Bill Wilson got in touch with him about the Roland Hazard affair was he said, you know, really what alcoholism is it's a yearning for a connection with something, with a connection with the divine, a connection with God. You know, what I've seen in every alcoholic is a desperate need to connect. And that's what so often drives the alcoholic into drinking. And he was very, very perceptive because that's so true with us. We are disconnected. We believe that everything revolves around us. You know, we are cut off from. You know, I heard a quote one time, and it was just so foreign to what I could even assimilate. One time I read a quote, and I believe it was from Albert Einstein, and he said, mankind's greatest mistake is believing there's more than one of us here. And I heard that, and I'm like, of course there's more than one of us here. There's me, and there's all of you. You know, what he was saying is, if you look at it spiritually, we're all God's children. We're all part of a wonderful manifestation of humanity. And when one of us suffers, we suffer. And what happens in the spiritual life as you grow more and more in the spiritual life is you become more attuned to this. One of the great promises is freedom from the bondage of self. That's one of the promises in the steps. And I believe what happens is as we grow spiritually, we become more compassionate. We become more helpful to other people, more understanding. We're less inclined to fight with and more inclined to help other people. And this is a sign of the transformation that happens when we start to heal spiritually. In the beginning, I was talking about this earlier in a meeting today. In the beginning, if you would have just offered me separation from alcohol, I would have bought the whole package and I would have called it a win. Because I just didn't want to die drinking in that kind of disgrace. But what I've found is, I've found that the treatment for alcoholism is about the best kind of treatment you could ever experience for a progressively fatal illness. That treatment is to grow spiritually and experience a whole slew of promises. There are some wonderful promises in Alcoholics Anonymous. The most satisfactory years of your life are ahead of you. Wow. You know, when you place your life in God's hands, he'll give you something much better than anything you could have planned. That's a great one. That's a great one. You know, you'll know a new freedom and a new happiness. There's some really great promises in here, folks. If you're part of a family system here, and you're here to support a loved one who's going through this recovery process, you know, you're part of the solution here this weekend. And that is really, really a wonderful thing. You're going to learn some things here that may go at odds with some of your own belief systems. Be open. Be open-minded to what is taught here. These people really know what they're doing. At a great level, they really know what they're doing. Many, many times we misunderstand the problem. We misunderstand the best way for us to move forward as family members. What happened with me with my family is basically this. They basically gave up on me. The day that they left, I kind of threatened their lives. I probably had a little bit to do with it, But the day that they left, and I remember calling them up, and I remember saying, please come back. I think I'm going to die. I was going through the VTs. I don't want to die by myself. And what they basically said to me was this. They said, we're not going to come back. we really don't think it would be fair to have to watch you die, and we really don't want to go through that. And I think that was a turning point for me. And that the turning point really was that I need to start seeking a solution to this problem. I can't have people help me with this problem. I need to seek a solution to this problem. And that's when I turned the corner, and that's when I really sought this recovery experience with everything I got. You know, I was lucky enough to get exposed to some people who really understood the mechanics and the experience of recovery. That was so influential in my life. One of the first lessons that I learned from one of my sponsors was this. I was going with him to celebrate 90 days. I hadn't had a recovery experience yet, so I was crippled with self-centered fear. And I was thinking for a week before I celebrated, oh my God, I'm going to get in front of people, I'm going to talk, I'm going to, oh my God, I don't know why you're making me do this, I'm going to get a coin. And what happened is we got in the car and we're going, he's going to celebrate 10 years, you know, he's got a complete different perspective on the world. And I'm horrible, like, oh. And I'm riding in the car and he looks at me and he goes, Chris, oh my God. Man, am I glad I don't feel like you do in 90 days. What? You know, he goes, no, listen, I'm not, you know, putting you down. I'm glad that I don't feel like I felt when I had a year. He goes, you know what? I'm glad I don't feel like I felt when I had 9 years. Chris, I'm glad I don't feel like the way I felt 2 weeks ago. What he was telling me was that recovery is accumulative. It gets better. We get better as long as we continue to do the right things, as long as we continue to practice these principles. He was telling me that. And I really listened because, again, I was just crippled with self-centered fear. And I went up and I celebrated 90 days, and this is basically what I said, really profound. I went up and they gave me a card and said, oh, my name's Chris, I'm not really good. It's my favorite to all these people. Oh, thank you. And I sat back down, you know, yeah. You're pathetic. You're not thank you so much for sharing. I feel so better now. Now that I've seen how pathetic you are. I'm glad I can help. But I listened to that lesson. I listened to that lesson. Let me tell you what, folks. I'll tell you right now. I am glad I don't feel the way I felt at 90 days. I am glad I don't feel the way I felt at a year. I am glad I don't feel the way I felt at 23 years. You know, every single day it gets a little bit better in my life. Every day I'm more grateful for being on this planet. You know, the saddest thing that I see is when we get to that place of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization and we don't think that we can go on. We've been granted this opportunity we're really spiritual beings having a human experience. That's really what's going on. And some of us are awake to that, and, you know, some of us aren't yet. But we've been granted the ability to experience life on this particular planet at this particular time with all these cool people. You know, what an unbelievable experience that we can have. And that's a shift in perception. To be grateful like that is a shift in perception that accompanies recovery. You know, thinking that life sucks, and I can't believe it, everything's terrible, that's a shift in perception that comes from, you know, being an unrecovered alcoholic or addict. So that shift in perception is what can happen when you experience recovery. Place spiritual growth absolutely first in your life. If you suffer from alcoholism or drug addiction, place that first. Don't make the mistake of chasing money, power, sex. Don't make the mistake of chasing that above your spiritual growth, and you'll be fine. Continue to make an effort to practice these principles in all your affairs, and you're fine. Another thing I heard at a meeting this morning that's absolutely true, why do we relapse? There's a couple of places in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that it tells us why. If we fail to perfect and enlarge our spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, there are low spots ahead that we may not be able to get through, you know, sober. So placing the welfare of others ahead of our own, how bizarre is that? If you're an alcoholic or an addict, you're like, what? But that's what happens. I've got a lot of friends in this room tonight. You know, I know a lot of you, and some of you have unbelievably good recovery. And you know what? Your phone is always ringing, and there's people always in your house, and there's always stuff going on, and it all has to do with helping other people to grow spiritually. And you want to know the happiest people I know? The people that are working with others, the people that are placing the welfare of others ahead of their own. You know, who would have thought that would be the way I would go? You know, because it was always about me. You know, I'm really, really grateful to be here tonight. I want to thank everybody for coming out. And, you know, if you're part of this process, you know, drink this Kool-Aid. Let me just say, because this is the real deal here. Please. Okay, that's all I got. Thanks.